All right, here we are. Smart Talk. Welcome back for another edition of the show. My guest today is George Kennedy, a retired Foreign Service officer who has served for 35 years in the service of the United States, been on many a continent, seven countries, and culminated in his appointment as Consul General in Toronto. He kept busy after retirement as a political advisor to several elected officials and advising small to medium-sized enterprises regarding opportunities in overseas market. George has been very, very busy. He's the author of, and I looked up online, 9 books, some novels, some self-help, and he has really covered a whole range. You give me a look, George. Am I getting it right? What am I missing?
Yes, you're right. You're right. I hadn't counted the e-books, but you're right.
I was doing the total.
Okay.
So we're going to do a couple of things today. We're going to talk about writing. A lot of you out there might be thinking about how do I become a novelist? Or say I've got some ideas for how people could live their life better. I'd like to write a self-help book, like on being a better mom or being a better dad or making money or anything like that. And I'm going to ask George to talk about how one actually goes through steps to get doing it. We're also going to talk about, after 35 years in the Foreign Service, we're going to talk about America in the world today, what's going on, contemporary things from Syria to Brexit to Russia to Turkey, and get George's opinion on that. I want to start out in introducing George by referring to his autobiography, Cotton Fields to Summits, The View from Contested Ground. And cotton fields, George, you grew up in the South?
No, I didn't, but before we begin, let me say, first of all, thank you for having me on this morning. I really appreciated the opportunity to come and kind of talk a bit about myself and my views. But the title is a misnomer. I was born and raised in South Jersey.
I want to say Tony Soprano to Summits, and you said no.
Well,
where do cotton fields come from?
Okay. When I was 8, my older brother and I traveled to South Carolina to visit with my uncle, a relative. My mother thought we were going to have a vacation, but like any 8-year-old, I was never really that conscious of being anything other than a kid. But in South Carolina, for the first time, I became aware not only of who I was, but what I was relative to my environment. I knew for the first time that I was Black. And people saw me as Black first, even as a kid. And I saw things that I had never seen before, like white fountains and white bathrooms and Black. And all of a sudden, I developed a sociological awareness I otherwise would not have. And so that became my introduction to George Kennedy, the Black kid, in an environment that was uniquely different from his own. And that became my introduction to the South and what made it different and where my grandparents had come from. And that was my formation, you might say.
It stayed with you ever since?
Ever since. Because it was the first time that I became aware of who I was and what I was other than the kid in his neighborhood going to school, doing things that kids do. Before that, nobody ever talked about being white or Black or that you were different and that you should be treated differently. That never happened to me in New Jersey. Not that it wouldn't later, but in South Carolina, from the moment we got off the train, my brother and I, it was like, you go there, and you saw people stepping off the sidewalk. And it's like, well, why are they doing that? But at the same time, you know, my uncle seemed he was comfortable because he was from the South. But I all of a sudden became aware that I'm different and they're treating me different. And I hadn't said anything, I hadn't done anything, but it was because I was Black.
Traumatic?
Very. Especially when you're a kid and you're wondering, like, well, why? That's the first question. What did I do? Did I say anything?
Did your mom or dad help you understand it better or talk to you about it? What kind of questions did you ask them about?
Well, you
what
see,
is
here's
this thing called South Carolina?
Here's the thing. when my brother and I tried to write home and explain to my parents what was going on, my aunt and uncle would censor our letters and not let us say anything negative about where we were. So we really couldn't share anything until we arrived home later in the summer. But you know what the consideration became? My maternal grandmother was the only sister of my uncle in South Carolina. And so do we say anything that's maybe going to upset her? So we just kept it within the family. But that became our introduction. And my mother then began to talk to us differently than she had before.
How does a kid from South Jersey with South Carolina experiences come to be in the Foreign Service?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. I was in the military, and I was being discharged. And the lieutenant who was supposed to discharge us that day happened to be late. And all returning veterans were given this manila envelope full of employment information. And the military was into recycling very early on because they knew we were so excited to be home, we would just throw this stuff away. Well, this lieutenant was late, and I kept sitting on this package, and I picked it up at some point, and I put it in my bag, and I forgot all about it. I had been home about a month, and now I'm unpacking, and I find this envelope. So I look in it, and there was this flyer from the State Department. They were recruiting returning veterans that had foreign experience, check. Language, check. Experience in foreign cultures, check. And then it said Europe. I thought, that's it. Why don't I apply?
Right.
And I figured, well, they're going to say thank you, but no thank you, but what the hell? I've got nothing else to do. I have no job. I'm home. So I began the process of applying to the State Department. And in those days, there was no internet. We had no phone. So you had a typewriter with carbon paper. So I would fill out these forms, and I would send them in. And months later, I'd get a response. And then I would respond. And this went on for about 6 months. I went to a Christmas party hosted by one of my high school teachers who said, Kennedy, he called me Ken, I want you to meet someone. And it was a young black guy. And he had one question. He says, what stage are you in the application process? And I told him. He said, well, you've been hired. You just don't know it. I said, I don't believe you. So again, I forgot all about it. 11 months after I applied, I get this letter from the State Department. He said, thank you, but in effect, no thank you. So I thought, I knew it. They weren't going to hire me. So I just forgot all about it. A month later, I get another letter, and I'm thinking, I don't need to be rejected twice. Once was enough. And they said, we are pleased to inform you that you have been appointed, and you will be assigned to the American Embassy in Bonn, Germany. I couldn't believe it.
Congratulations. Congratulations. Right. You know, James Baldwin went abroad. Race in America was difficult, and went to Europe to find things. When you served abroad, did you find experiences with different nationalities similar to South Carolina or more like New Jersey? How did your race play when
totally
you were in Europe?
Totally the opposite. Totally the opposite, because for the first time, and I'll put it in very honest terms, I came to understand what it felt like to be white in America, because there I was just accepted as George Kennedy. No one
American.
Treated Yeah, I was an American. It was never about race. Even in the heat of argument, no one ever referred to my race. They just referred to my Americanness. And so I was accepted in a way that I was not accepted in my own country. And I could go anywhere. I could interact with anyone. And I was completely at home. The only challenge was one that many Americans didn't accept, and that was learn to communicate in the local language. And I discovered I have a facility for languages. I love the challenge. And so I learned to speak German. And I had a very, very positive experience. So I enjoyed being abroad, in fact, much more so than I did being in my own country, unfortunately.
35 years later, you step out of service, and you take up the mantle of, amongst other things, novelist. And let's do a quick thing there. What made you decide to, or why did you get interested in writing?
Well, Foreign Service officers are prolific writers because that is part of the craft you have to master. So I've always written, but living in a world of nonfiction, it's a different style of writing. And a colleague of mine, a friend of mine in the gym one morning said, "George, I read your memoir. I liked it. Have you ever considered writing fiction?" I said, "Fiction? Life for me has not been about fiction. I don't know how to write fiction. I don't read fiction." And he said something which really stuck. He said, "Well, George, why don't you try it? You've got nothing depending on the outcome." And something about the challenge stuck. And so I went home and I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, where would I begin?
And they always say, write about what you know. And so hang with us for a second, folks. We got to take a break, and when we get back, we'll ask George briefly about his first novel, and then we're going to turn to foreign affairs and talk about what's going on with America and the world. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host. Welcome back. We're here with George Kennedy, Foreign Service officer for 35 years, now living in the larger Tucson area, Marana. I guess
Marana,
I should give you credit for that.
You.
Talking about George growing up, talking about George turning to novels. He's written a number of books. I just want to briefly mention a trilogy of sort of thrillers. Give me a couple of words.
Political fiction.
The first one's called Crosshairs, an intriguing story of love, friendship, ambition, and betrayal. That about covers the human condition, doesn't
that
it?
That does.
A second one, Attack on a Principal. Was that a high school principal or a principal of
no,
life?
No, we're referring to principals in government. Principals
like
and presidents
it.
And cabinet members and those the Secret Service calls principals.
And the third one just came out in her own right. And that one, in a nutshell, is about?
The vice president who becomes the president earns her second term in her own right. She's no longer the inheritor. She
gotcha.
Now has earned her own place.
And if you get on Amazon.com or go to your favorite bookstore or go to BarnesandNoble.com, you can find all these books listed and you can order them. Let's turn for a second now to some topics about what's going on in the world, and particularly as an ex-Foreign Service officer who served abroad, you should have some good opinions and insights to doing this. Let's start with the situation of Turkey, the Kurds, and Syria. People have asked me, they've said, Al, can we trace this problem and instability in the Middle East back to the Iraq wars under the Bush administration, or do they even go further, or are they more recent? What's the origin of the condition we're in now, in your opinion, in Syria?
In my opinion, what we're dealing with now is a failure of American leadership to understand the historical evolution of our relationship with the Kurds. And the thing is, when the United States engages in conflict or trying to resolve conflicts abroad, we have to have allies that we can depend upon that can take the word of American leadership to the bank, so to speak. And what we have done is something that is unusual in American history, and that is we have betrayed a valuable ally, allies that have fought with us against ISIS, against terrorists. You know, we do not always engage directly in conflict ourselves. We have to have friends and allies and those who are willing to support us. And one of the things that all of our allies have been able to depend upon since the end of World War II, and that is the value, the word of American leadership. When we give our word, they take it to the bank. When we betray that, then we find it much more difficult to again solicit the support of allies in wars that preserve our security and theirs as well.
To that, you often hear a realpolitik, that is, a realism argument. I think it was a British who said, We have no allies. We only have interests. And you would know better than others that geopolitics is a brutally rough game. To this position, respond, vis-a-vis Russia and other significant players in the region, Turkey is an emerging ally. That the Iraqs get sold down the river, as terrible as that is, would you say, Al, that's, I feel sorry for them. The tragedy for them is that it happens again and again, but that's just the nature of geopolitics, and no country has a promise to help people, and it keeps forever. It's only when it's in their interest. How much of the idealism that you've just talked about is really a cover for the brutality of actual living geopolitics?
Well, you know, it depends on your perspective. What you've described, I think, is much more narrow, more cynical approach to foreign affairs that is a luxury we cannot afford. For example, not only is Turkey an ally, Turkey is a member of NATO, but the Russians are a strategic adversary. We have, I feel, permanent interests in the Middle East, and one of the things that we try to do is maintain stability in a region that is very volatile. Syria is definitely an adversary, and one of the things that we wanted to do was not only maintain stability, but remain, I think, preserve a fealty with an ally that obviates the necessity to put American troops on the ground to defend American interests. And what we have done is create a breach of trust. And in foreign policy, trust is very important. Trust among allies is very important. Even trust among our adversaries to know that when they cross a certain line, they can trust that America will respond.
And from that point, when Obama drew the line in the sand about the use of gas by Assad and didn't do anything, was that a betrayal of American trust?
Personally, I believe it was, because we had made the commitment. And when you draw a line, and perhaps we should not have drawn a line, and I'm sure his people will argue with this, but when we drew a line, again, we're talking about American honor, American integrity, American commitment. When you draw a line and someone crosses it, well, I feel that we had the responsibility, we had the obligation to respond as we had said we would.
One more quick question, and I'll move to another topic. If we have permanent interest there, does that mean that the endless war of loss of American blood and treasure in the Middle East should just continue forever and ever? Is there an end point?
Yes, there is. And I think there can be a negotiated end point. I've never been an advocate for permanent war, but I do feel that we could have negotiated a withdrawal which allowed us to maintain the support of our allies, maintain the support of the Kurds, and at the same time, respect American leadership and American interest in the region. But it has to be negotiated. Abrupt withdrawal? No. We had already drawn down, but then there was the surge, and we reintroduced troops. But I feel we could have negotiated a withdrawal to the point where we would not have been active participants in any hostilities.
Is there ever a right way to leave an area? And what I'm thinking of is, we all remember those images at the end of the Vietnam War, the helicopter on top of the building, and people are getting in, and then there's too many helicopters leaving with people on the aircraft carrier, and they just push them off the side to make room for the next one landing. And it is a sort of undignified or bad way to end it. We have this abrupt thing by Trump to just leave. Now he's pulling back some. Is that the way it ends up often just being? I mean, what would be an example of a great way to leave that you could think of in history?
Well, I believe the way we negotiated the end of World War II, the way we negotiated our withdrawal from South Korea, the end of the Korean War. Again, when you talk about ending a war, it depends upon what your...
Get closer to the mic, George.
Oh, it depends upon what our strategic objectives were. But when you talk about a right way and a wrong way, it depends on which side of the aisle you sit on. And I believe that for us to preserve our credibility, to preserve the value of American leadership, we can negotiate our way out of wars, as we have done. But just to precipitously change our goals and walk away, no. Because don't forget, if you look at the American presence around the globe, we depend on allies to help us project American leadership. So we are always in a position where we have to negotiate with allies and negotiate with adversaries. And I feel that to do that, you have to have a plan. And today, I don't feel we have a plan. I feel we just act almost precipitously, emotionally, without an understanding of what our goals are.
Do you have a sense of how all this is going to end up? If I were to say, what will the Middle East look like in 5 years, 10 years? What does badly mean?
Badly means that it will be much more difficult for the United States to reintroduce the ability of this country to wield the level of influence that we previously enjoyed in the Middle East, because we will have lost the one thing that we have depended on since World War II, and that is respect for American leadership, credibility, and the value of an American commitment. You don't just pick that up once you have thrown that away. You just don't do that. So I think even if we were to have a different president in 2020, I don't think we'll be able to just go back into the Middle East and resume where we were in 2016. It doesn't work that way. Nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very astute observation. At the same time, like the British before World War I, beginning to pull forces back from various places in the world that they no longer could maintain the British presence. Clearly, the other side of America's world, if not dominance, at least presence to ensure things, seems to find a sense of pulling out of the Middle East as much as we were, and more concerned now with East Asia. People talk about the rise of a China-U.S. rivalry, and sometimes more than a rivalry. There are books about the coming war with China, et cetera, et cetera. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I think today China is not only a strategic competitor, but I think they are a strategic adversary. China today is not the China of 1949 or China of 1970 when Nixon opened the door to China. You know, when we brought the Chinese into the World Trade Organization, they were a $1 trillion economy. Today, they are a $14 trillion economy. They have a global presence. They have $3 trillion in reserves, and that gives them the power to actually influence and shape outcomes everywhere.
Was that a mistake to bring them in, knowing that they introduced a kind of authoritarian capitalism or whatever you want to call it? That is, the thought of bringing them in would make them more rules-oriented, world economy, liberal, Western, and under Xi Jinping, it seems, in fact, that they've become more authoritarian than Deng Xiaoping earlier. So, thoughts?
I don't think we can afford to leave an economy of that size outside the tent, so to speak. I think we will have to engage with the Chinese in at least over the period of the next decade, because they are in the ability... They have the ability to compete with us militarily, economically. And when a country is that much of a competitor, a threat, our engagement has to be long-term. We have to have medium to long-term strategic goals that we are willing to pursue non-militarily. And that is, you do that through diplomacy, through negotiation. So we are going to have to engage the Chinese, I think, in perpetuity, simply because they're only getting larger.
Well put. We're going to take a break now. When we get back, I'm going to ask George what is his biggest worry about United States in the world today. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson. We're back with George Kennedy, longtime Foreign Service officer, served on many continents, and is also a novelist and a writer of other kinds of books. We're talking about America and the world today. George, the last thing I want to talk about is, what do you worry the most about in terms of world affairs? If you had your darkest view, you'd say, Al, you know, probably not, but what I really worry about the most is...
What I worry about today is a lack of respect for American leadership and our ability to influence, perhaps even shape, outcomes in the contemporary world. For example, one of the reasons that we have survived and have prospered to the extent that we have since the end of World War II was because we were able to build an international coalition to support the kinds of international institutions like the United Nations, for example, that actually encourage nations to resolve their differences through negotiation and diplomacy rather than conflict. And we've always led that effort. When we asked the world to look at market-driven economies, for example, as opposed to economies that were driven by state goals, for example, they did. And today, now that we have spent seven decades building respect for American leadership, not that they've always agreed with us, but at least they were willing to negotiate with us to accept American leadership. What I fear today is a loss of respect for that leadership, and I feel that others are going to compete with us successfully for it.
Let me pick up on that and toss it back to you another way. What if after the Second World War, the United States was the only major, first only major nuclear, but then Russia got the bomb, but was clearly the dominant economy in the world, and in fact got its way not so much because of respect of leadership, but because there really was no choice. And over time, with the rise of East Asia and in the world economy, the return of Europe, the unipolarity or the one dominance of the United States has been slipping. And so in some sense, it's the loss of respect is actually just the inability to get your way the way you had in the 50s and even part of the 60s. That is it more objective conditions rather than just sort of psychological respect that's really leading us to this much more uncertain world we're in?
Well, I don't know that I agree with that. I feel that one of the things that makes the difference today is, again, our ability to engage even our adversaries, even our enemies, because you see, the United States is still the society that the Chinese and the Russians both want to have a strategic relationship with. If you look at the preferred destination for Chinese students today, where do they want to send their students? To the U.S. What language do they want to learn? English. And so everyone wants to engage with us, and I feel that gives us a unique opportunity to influence policies, for example, in places like China and in the Soviet Union.
We got a caller on the phone. Charles, you're on. You got a question or a statement for our guest?
I have one very fast statement for you and a question for the guest. Alice is an excellent interview. It really teaches. Mr. Kennedy, thank you for your service to the country, both in the military and in the State Department. My question is, you're of an age where you would know who Alger Hiss was and what his affiliations were. And how do you take advantage of the association of an organization like the UN? Of course, there aren't really any other UNs, but how do we take advantage of that organization without having it being used as another beachhead to establish some form of Marxism in the United States? And I will listen to your answer on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles. Good question.
Very good question. My approach to the United Nations has always been, we have the perfect forum for the exchange of views. We have the perfect opportunity to at least shape the opinions of those who would disagree with us. And again, what we are interested in is maintaining stability, a certain order in the world, because the kinds of problems that a lot of the developing societies are going to be grappling with in the future, like cultural wars, famine, disease, etc., they do not have the ability to resolve these issues themselves. And by bringing those to a forum where their views can be expressed and we can talk about ways that we can work with them to deal with conflict, to forge solutions to problems that we do not want to see crossing borders that eventually have an impact on this country, we have the ability to maintain that dialogue in the United Nations. I'm not worried about the spread of Marxism, for example. What I'm worried about is a world in which we no longer maintain the kind of leadership that we have, and people resort to the age-old solutions to resolving conflict, and that is war. Because whenever there is a war somewhere, you can bet that we are going to become involved simply because it is not in our best interest or the best interest of that particular continent to have ongoing conflict. Because again, they look to us, to the U.S. What are you going to do about genocide in Rwanda, for example? And we fail to respond. We are the world's greatest responder when it comes to humanitarian crises, for example. So if we lack the ability to shape outcomes, where does that leave us? And so my response always has been, I'd rather see the United States engaged in protracted negotiation, protracted diplomacy, as opposed to having to pick up the pieces of conflict, in which then we may have to commit American troops, American blood, American treasure in wars that the average American doesn't understand where it is and why we're involved. That is the reason why we have the United Nations. I'd rather get people in a room and argue than the people pick up guns and shoot each other.
It reminds me of the old saying, better to have loved and lost than never loved before. And George's version would be better to have negotiated and failed mm-hmm. than never have negotiated before. Let me ask you another question. How much do you think domestic policy will drive foreign policy, or how much today do you think our domestic policies of the present administration in terms of re-election, and also the Democrats in terms of positions they're taking in terms of elections, is driving present foreign policy?
One of the difficulties I have, as I'm a political junkie, and I have been all of my life, and one of the difficulties I have today is if I were a foreign service officer on duty anywhere, and someone were to ask me, well, George, you know, what is American policy vis-a-vis? I'd have to say, I don't know. I don't know that we have a coherent domestic policy other than America first. Well, we tried that back in the 1930s, and guess what? We wound up in World War II. So I don't know that we have a coherent set of goals which we can define as domestic policy. But does it have an impact? Domestic policy always shapes our foreign policy. One flows from the other. And so today, I think if you look at our allies, they ask the question, what is this administration's approach to policy? What is the policy? How do we intersect with that? Just take a U.S.-European relations, for example. Now, when you talk about America first, what does that mean? More tariffs? Does that mean that there is a give and take when it comes to exports and imports into the American versus the European market for American agricultural exports? What does it mean? And when people have more questions about our policy than they do understanding and the ability to engage it, we have a problem.
Let me ask you then. Your position is we don't have policies.
Yes.
In a couple of brief sentences or a couple of brief bullet points, what would you make three cornerstones of a George Kennedy foreign policy?
Oh, that's a very, very good question.
Put you on the spot. Yeah, it's one thing to go around and criticize everyone for not doing things and acting on the seat of their pants and just withdrawing without planning. We need plans.
It's one of the great things about being retired. I can move from being an activist.
President Kennedy, what?
Right.
Well, I've got to say George Kennedy. President Kennedy, let me ask you at this news conference, what is your plan for the United States foreign policy?
Well, I would build a policy around the concept of engagement. Engagement with our allies, engagement with our adversaries. Two, I would talk about a commonly held set of internationally respected norms. What are the expectations that we have of each other as sovereign nations to conduct negotiations with each other? Thirdly, I would say, we should have a policy which, in effect, builds respect for the differences, especially the differences that cannot be bridged. And so if we can agree on at least several basic ideas, now we have the basis for dialogue.
And the question, the follow-up question, obviously is, since we don't, why don't we? Why are we in the boat we're in?
We're in the boat we're in because we have, I feel, an administration that, I don't think they expected to win. And when they did win, I do not think that we had an administration that had actually looked at the world as it exists and had developed a coherent set of policies and strategies to confront it other than just an individual's personal view about what the world should look like and how he felt he could shape it by using strongman tactics. And in today's world, that doesn't work. Countries have learned how to say no.
Let's turn for a second to Russia. There's the question of Russian interference in American elections. There's the question of whether NATO moved too far east and the Russians are legitimately feeling threatened and pushing back. What's your opinion of what Russia is up to today?
What I feel the Russians are up to, what the Russians have been up to for the past 20 years, and that is challenging the United States for leadership, not only in what was formerly called the old Soviet Union or Eastern Europe, but it too is waging a war of ideas. It is waging a war to shape domestic public opinion in this country about Russia itself. Because as a competitor, see, the Russians today are also competing with the Chinese for the first time and with the United States. We were historically the only adversary, but now they've got the Chinese. And so the Russians are fighting to rebuild what was formerly the old Soviet Empire. But we are the adversary, the enemy, much more so, I think, than the Chinese are. The Chinese are a neighbor. But we are the power with which they have to compete for influence worldwide.
Unless the Chinese keep migrating into Siberia and someday you get a Siberian independence movement that wants to connect with Russia. We're going to get back to that and more topics. We've got to take a break and we're going to ask George about how to get into publishing. So stick with us. Smart Talk again. Al Bergeson, your host. You've been talking with George Kennedy, 35-year foreign service specialist stationed all over the world. We've been talking about world politics. But George is also an author, and he's written novels and self-help books. I want to talk about the novels. You know, they say write about what you know. Did you find that helpful for you, or did you read other, like, spy books, La Carre and whatnot, and sort of use those for inspiration?
No, I drew on my experience, and I'm one of those who went back and took a look at history and said, what if? I love to ask the what if.
Counterfactuals.
Yes, I love. And what would history look like had X, Y, and Z happened? But for people who want to get into writing, I think everyone has a story. everyone has something that really triggers them. It could be fiction, it could be history, it could be poetry, whatever it is that gets you going, and you want to tell a story. Ask yourself, you know, how creative do I feel? And I say, writing is like anything else. You have to bring certain attributes to it. Like, look at your job, for example. You know that you've got to be committed. You've got to be passionate about whatever you do. And you have got to respect what it takes to get the job done. So I say, if you have a story, begin. Just start talking about that issue.
Okay, so let me ask you, as the tempered, balanced, 35 years within the envelope, Foreign Service officer, not to offend, not saying being bland, mm-hmm. but basically blah, blah, blah. How did you come to juice up your novels or overcome your 35 years of balance to get something with some drama and some excitement and so people would love reading it?
Because my attitude was, on this particular day, what if, for example, an event that I was a participant in just happened to change?
Got an example?
For example, you are sitting on the tarmac in Brussels and you're waiting for President Bush to return from a meeting at NATO. What if, for example, a group of terrorists had rushed onto the tarmac and began shooting up that plane with me sitting there about 50 yards away, like, what in the hell just happened? So you look at something like that and you say, what is the possibility that it could have happened? Yes, it could have. Or you find yourself sitting on an aircraft with former Secretary Ron Brown and you're in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And what if at the time we were dealing with an ISIS and they had decided, first black African-American Secretary of Commerce, let's take him out. And we were sitting in a special air mission G5 aircraft sitting on the tarmac. He's in a meeting with a member of Saudi government. What if? And so it was easy to imagine it because I was in Italy during the time when the Brigate Rosse was shooting up the Fiumicino airport, an airport that I was visiting at least once a week. Or when Gaddafi downed that Pan Am flight in Lockerbie, I used to take that flight all the time, coming back to the United States from Brussels. So to me, these weren't far-fetched. These were things that easily could have happened and that you had to assume might happen if you were at the airport catching a plane to come home. Okay. All of a sudden.
So you've had a very exciting life, and finding dramatic incidents isn't so hard because, in point of fact, you've been in some.
Yes, that's true.
And you
true.
Could easily imagine, like the terrorists on the tarmac, them happening. Let's imagine you're an ordinary person who would like to write about their life and can't think of anything dramatic. What kind of tips or suggestions do you have to get the muse going or to generate some stuff?
Well, I think it also helps if you are an imaginative person. You are creative. It helps if you read a lot or if you have friends that you just enjoy exchanging ideas with, or if you read, and or if you're the kind of person that asks the question, what if? And you are intellectually curious and you do a little research and you explore ideas, you have to bring some of that to it. Or suppose you are a housewife who, well, I don't want to denigrate housewives, but let's say that you're a housewife and you've always had, like my mother, for example. I didn't know that my mother was one of those who always wanted to visit Mount Etna in Sicily. Suppose, for example, she had just decided to do a little research. And during the course of that, she discovered that Sicily had a certain very bloody history with the mafia, for example, and she decided, wow, that could be interesting. And so you just create a scenario.
You just make it up.
You just make it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's where imagination is really helpful. I think the average one of us, apart from what we do for a living, there's another dimension to us. the things that we think about, the things that we like, that part of us that we not don't necessarily share.
And doesn't need to be clamped down by the job, such as
exactly.
you as the neat, precise, never out of line foreign service officer.
See, I'm different.
Has another side right. that you can let go. What are you reading now? Books on your bedstand.
Right now, I'm reading a book by President Obama's National Security Advisor, Susan Rice. I'm reading that. There's another book by...
Do you like it?
I do, because...
Why?
Well, again, because it overlaps with my former Foreign Service career, and I recognize some of the characters in it. In fact, Susan Rice says one of the reasons that she was so successful in New York as our UN ambassador was because of her deputy, an officer named Alejandro Wolf. Well, Alex Wolf and I served together in Brussels back in the 80s, so I knew him.
Are you mentioned in the book?
No, I'm not. Because,
big mistake.
Well, what can I tell you? You know, you can't make them all. I was in Toronto at that time, but I knew him. I knew some of the other characters in the book, and I was familiar with some of the crises they were confronting. I'm sure she would argue with me about joining the red line in Syria because she talks about it.
Yeah. Favorite authors in the past, great books you've really enjoyed and you'd recommend someone reading if they want to start out and learn just sort of the basic three-act structure or something of a novel or a book, things that sort of inspired you early on?
Well, you know, again, the things that inspired me early on were the writings of political authors, because, you see, I didn't read fiction. And so I wasn't, I don't know who the great fiction
George
writers.
George Orwell? Do you like George's essays?
I knew of George Orwell, of course. But I'm the last person that could tell someone, if you read this author and this author and this author, I don't know. Because
Kissinger's memoirs, did you read and enjoy those?
I have everything he's ever written. So I have all of Kissinger's memoirs. I have noted American historians like George Kennan, who wrote the famous X Telegram, which talked about how we adopted the policy of containment of the Soviet Union after World War II. So I've read all of that. I mean, I have a library full of it. So I read things like that because I was an aspiring Foreign Service officer. I always felt that I had the ability to reach the senior service. And so I wanted to be as knowledgeable about all of the writings and the views of those giants who shaped American policy after World War II.
Heroes in history, Talleyrand, Bismarck, Foreign Service people who, as idealists or crude realists, but in the end did what needed to be done, that have been sort of role models, or at least people you looked up to.
Well, the people that I looked up to, the Dean Acheson's, for example. I looked up to the people who understood that at a certain point in history, the world was in chaos. And chaos leads to greater instability. So how do you bring order to a chaotic world? And who were those giants that helped to bring that order, that could conceive of something like the United Nations? I look to people like the Churchills. I look to the Dean Achesons and the George Kennans and people who said, here is what we can do to bring some order to the world that we live in. And being a product of that era and understanding the necessity for it, they became my early heroes. What I liked about Kissinger was he was a pragmatist. I didn't always agree with him, but he was a pragmatist. And when I was in Rome, Kissinger was in Rome every other month, and I knew people on his staff. Yes.
What was he like talking to?
Difficult. Because his thing was, if he didn't know you and if you didn't register, it was like, who are you?
It reminds me of his famous saying about, someone asked him about, what about Latin America, South America and world politics? Oh, yes, very important. He said, it's a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica. It's a famous example. You also write self-help books.
I do.
8 Steps. In a short time, we're running on time here a little. If I'm looking for some motivation, you're my Tony Robbins sitting across from me, except you're George Kennedy. What eight steps should I take?
Well, one of the things I feel you have to have, you've got to recognize that you've got to be motivated. You have to be disciplined. You have to be focused. You have to be willing to commit to pursuing an objective, which has to be defined. It has to be achievable. And you have to recognize what your talents are, your strengths, your weaknesses. And then you have got to be committed to your success. And if you can put all of these things together, you can be successful. Most people I have found harbor greater doubt than they do belief in their ability to be successful. And I'm one of those who believes that each of us is capable of success. You just have to understand what it takes to achieve success. The same thing on your job. So there are steps that I recommend that people take. And I say it begins with the idea of how do you define, what does success mean for you?
And once you get that, you can then connect all the pieces.
Yes.
And put them together. Do you ever read any of the coaches' books on being successful, like John Wooden?
Yes, I do.
40 seconds left. You
have
a favorite?
I haven't read John Wooden, but I like the Tony Robbins. I like the Jim Rohns. I have listened to all of their tapes. I've read most of their books. And what I found was that...
There's the music. We're going to have to cut
off.
George, can we have you back sometime? This has been a great show. Love it.
Thank you
very
much.
All right, folks, we're getting near the end. See you all next time. Al Bergeson for Smart Talk.